So you want to find out how to not sound boring? Well, you've come to the right place. Today, we have Bill McGowan. Bill is the founder and CEO of Clarity Media Group and one of the world's top communication coaches. He's advised leaders at Amazon, Meta, LinkedIn, Spotify, as well as Oscar, Emmy, and Grammy winners, Olympic champions, and White House staffers. Bill helps people break away from buzzwords and bland messaging to communicate with clarity, conviction, and memorability. Wow, that's a tough word. His upcoming book, Speak Memorably, is a masterclass in finding your authentic voice and standing out in a world where everyone sounds the same. What if the reason people tune you out when you talk isn't because of what you say, but how you say it? In this episode, legendary communication coach and best-selling author Bill McGowan breaks down the real reasons most people sound the same and how you can instantly stand out. We explore why most presentations fail, how to break free from corporate speak, and what the best communicators do differently. Bill shares powerful strategies from his new book, Speak Memorably. You can order it in the description. Do it now. These strategies include the 3 P's of delivery, how to write for the ear and not the eye, and the tools that make people remember your words. You'll learn how to create original, authentic content and why ChatGPT can't actually do it for you. I know, unbelievable. Whether you're pitching an idea, leading a meeting, or giving a toast, this episode will give you the tools to sound clear, captivating, and confident. And with that being said, cue the intro music. Why does everyone sound the same nowadays?
In business settings, I find that very few people have ever been coached on how to communicate effectively. You wind up in meetings, you wind up listening to people on stage giving a presentation. They've never had any formal guidance on how to do it properly. And everybody lapses into what I call this conformity zone, where you use the same language, the same words, the same cliche expressions, the same jargon. And ultimately, we learn through osmosis. So we're watching somebody on stage and we pick up a lot of bad habits. And then when it's our turn to give a presentation, we think that's the way it should be done. So all these bad instincts wind up getting magnified. And ultimately, what has to happen is people have to understand the simpler the better. Exercise an economy of words, don't drone on, and try to say things that stick in people's memory.
So if sounding like everyone else isn't the optimal way to communicate, what does our capacity to sound different allow us to actually achieve?
Whenever the human ear detects something that sounds incredibly familiar, let's say you went to a meeting on Monday and somebody presented, and then the same exact language and framing and terminology was used, even if it's a little bit of a different subject on Wednesday, it feels almost redundant to the human ear. And, you know, there's a great expression and a quote from Dr. Seuss who said, I'm going to paraphrase it, that if your goal is to fit in, you're not going to be able to stand out. And ultimately, standing out is what you want to achieve. And if you're falling into the same patterns, the same sound, the same speech patterns as everybody else, then the ear detects, oh, I think I've heard this before, I'm going to half tune out. That has a detrimental effect on memory. So all these cliche expressions, well, it's part of our DNA, or We're guided by our North Star, or we're on a journey here. Oh, I mean, come on. I mean, this stuff has been said over and over and over again. We meet consumers wherever they are. These expressions wind up being so repeated, they're threadbare. And if you want to stand out, I'm not saying don't communicate those ideas, but don't lapse into the way everybody else has said them. Put a little time in and figure out what's a different, fresh, original way of saying this.
You said something earlier, which I found really fascinating, is that our voices are very much impacted by the voices around us. We've picked up certain cliches, certain normalities from the voices that we have grown up with. Is it actually possible for us to have our own individual voice, even when it stems from other people?
One of the best ways we advise people to nail this idea of authenticity and having it be in your own voice has to do with how you go about creating content. Now, when most people have to give a speech or presentation, their first mistake is sitting at a laptop and writing it out. That is a step you should never do. And there's a reason for that. Because unless you've worked in television or radio, your style of writing is one that's meant for the eye, not the ear. We tend to write in longer, flowier, prosier, complex sentences with introductory phrases and parenthetical clauses, and that's not exactly how we speak. We also tend to write in a more formal, stilted way, words that we don't necessarily say across a dinner table to a friend. Now, what I recommend people do if they want to create content is make yourself an outline on a big index card of what it is you want to say. And then take your phone and launch Otter AI or one of these other apps that records you and transcribes what you say. Then get up with your index card and just say it as it would come to you naturally. Don't worry if it's full of starts and stops and stumbles and mistakes. That doesn't really matter. Then take the transcription of what you've said and export that to a Word document or whatever application you're going to wind up doing your writing on, and make that your rough first draft. And what you're going to find is, stylistically, this is a hack. This is a hack to get you to write for the ear instead of the eye without that TV or radio experience. And what you're going to find is it's a much more casual and conversational style of communicating. That's one. There's another big benefit. You will never be at odds with your content because those words reflect how you instinctively want to express yourself. It is not a result of somebody else writing your content for you that you now have to deliver. Or even worse, you've put into ChatGPT, hey, knock me out a speech. I have to give a toast at a wedding. Knock me out a toast that touches on X, Y, and Z. Well, you're going to be at odds with that because you didn't write it. And in fact, you didn't even think of it. So, you know, an LLM thought of it for you. So this is a critical first step in creating authentic content.
Oh, that's so fascinating. I was watching a podcast the other day. I can't remember which it was, but Vanessa Van Edwards was on it. And she's obviously a brilliant communication coach as well. And she talked about this study that maybe her team did on Shark Tank. And I think this note of the casualness is very interesting because she dissected that the people that typically came with a script of statistics when the sharks asked all these questions, they came off as almost less intelligent to the sharks. But the people who obviously had them, they didn't sound like they made it up on the spot, had them, but they didn't come with a set script. The casualness of when they thought about the responses to the questions, the actual naturalness that they had, is that even a word? Yeah, the way they naturally responded, that came off as more intelligent because it showed that it was more instinctual rather than scripted.
Nobody wants to have just data points fire hosed at them one after the other. That does sound like a very rote performance.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we talk about in Speak Memorably is the importance of not just providing selective and curated data, but having context behind that data. Just throwing out a number to people doesn't necessarily mean anything. Like, I was working with a utility company that's building all these windmill. It's a windmill farm off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. And they were talking about how it's going to generate 100,000 megawatts of power every 6 months or whatever the time frame was. I said, well, you know, listen, unless I'm in the energy industry, I don't really know what that means. Is it good? Is it bad? Does it power my toothbrush for a week or what? And they said, well, you know, it can probably light the city of Boston for a year. I said, okay, now that means something. Like, that is the parenthetical explainer you need to have on the tail end of the 100,000 megawatts of power.
Yeah.
Because now the number means something to somebody.
What part of the communication is actually more important? The actual content that we're talking of, or how we deliver that content?
Both. They're equal parts. And I have seen people who are very good at the performance element of it, but when the content is poor, it's like an actor in a movie. You probably have favorite actors, and they're given a crummy script to work with. Their performance suffers as a result. And you're thinking, wow, I really like this actor, and I see her in a lot of things. Why does she seem kind of bad in this movie? Yeah. It's the content. But then I've also seen people with great content not land their big points because they're not using execution strategies that help your most important content stand out more.
Let's start with one. Let's talk about delivery. What are typical delivery mistakes we all tend to make?
Most people go way too fast, and most people are unaware of how fast they go. In my experience, people who are supremely confident and demonstrate a lot of maturity and executive presence, they are the ones who feel the license to take their time. They're the ones who have absolutely no apology around pausing, even in the middle of a sentence. Barack Obama is a perfect example of that. He doesn't care if you're seeing him flip through the card catalog in his brain about what word he wants to use next. He's got such gravitas that you can wait till I pick just the perfect word. And in that way, he's seeming supremely thoughtful and very selective. Going too fast is one of them. And then having everything you say be in a very narrow range. That means don't have all the information that's coming out be at one speed, because that's going to actually create a situation where the ear is sort of brought into this stupor. When the ear receives information at this consistent, predictable speed, it lulls the ear to sleep a little bit. What you want to do is you want to disrupt your pace. And the rule of thumb is you want sections where you're speaking nice and briskly, and you want sections where you dramatically shift downwards, slow down, say it more emphatically and deliberately. And the rule of thumb is, the more important the information you are communicating, the slower you should be going. And then when you're on the just conversational connective tissue, the secondary thoughts that connect you from important point A to important point B, then you can step on the gas and be nice and brisk and conversational, but don't blow through your main points. And it's that variance of speed that stimulates the ear. And I often say to clients, are you a parent? Yes. Remember when your kids were 2-3 years old and you couldn't get them to sleep? Yep. What did you do? You put them in the car seat and you went for a ride. And the ride would put them to sleep. But you take the car out on the parkway where that rhythmic thump of the creases in the roadway had this hypnotic effect on them. You didn't take them out in midtown bumper-to-bumper traffic where you're accelerating and braking. That's not what you do. But that accelerating and braking with your vocal pace is what keeps the audience attentive. So pace is one. Pitch is another. A lot of people don't necessarily reflect the mood of what it is they're saying in their voice. And this is where telling bedtime stories is a great training ground for how you should fluctuate your pitch. Even in the beginning of a story. So if I were to say to a friend this afternoon, I had an interesting conversation with a guy named Rishi today on a podcast. That's flat in terms of pitch, right? But if I had a once upon a time cadence to my voice to signal I'm starting in on a story, it would sound more like, you know, I had a fascinating talk with a guy today. Once upon a time, It has the same pitch. It has the same pitch lilt to it. And then the other thing that's a counterintuitive device, where most people think, okay, I'm getting to my big point. I need to hit it louder, harder.
Yeah.
That's not what you do. Sometimes pull back, lower your volume, keep up your intensity, make people lean in and listen to you more closely. So those three devices, your pace, your pitch, and your projection, the three Ps, keeping those in a state of variance is crucial to keeping your audience's attention. And if you've got their attention and they're captivated, they're going to remember what you say.
Yeah, I think a lot of the problems people typically have is that we look at phenomenal speakers and we go, can we actually be like them? Are these three principles something that actually can be taught and learned?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I teach them every day. And people are astonished at the difference in how the information is conveyed when they make variance a critical strategy in their delivery.
Hmm.
You know, a lot of times you hear somebody, oh God, I couldn't listen to that guy. It was so monotone. It's usually not monotone. It's usually mono-paced, where everything came out of my mouth at the same exact speed, and there's never any break here. There's never any pausing, and I'm going to just talk and talk and talk. You can't listen to that for very long, nor can you listen to someone who is just very consistently plodding in everything they say. That also becomes really tiresome. It's got to have elements of both.
So let's start with the pace element. How do we develop that? How do we learn that? What can we actually do and practice?
You need to figure out, if you're working from notes, whatever it may be, you need to create pausing in the middle of sentences, first and foremost. Figure out where you need to breathe. Where are the natural thematic openings and opportunities for you to actually put three little dots in the middle of a sentence that signals to you, this is a half beat pause, this is where you breathe. A lot of people say an entirely long sentence, and then when they get to the end of it, they're out of breath, and then before the next sentence, you know, this big intake of air. And that's because they are not breathing in the middle of sentences. They just plow through it without stopping. So figuring out where the natural pauses, even in the middle of sentences, are. Like, I took a pause before the word even there, and it gave me an opportunity to take a quick breath. That really works.
And it's important to, like you said before, get that script naturally in, and then you notice these pauses, rather than incorporate these pauses before you even say the words.
You have to figure out where the pauses go based on recording yourself and understanding also, where does the audience just need a beat here to chew and digest what I just said? You know, overwhelming them and fire hosing information at them doesn't help in terms of how much they're going to remember what you say. If you overwhelm your audience, they're going to give up. Same holds true for getting too detailed, too complex, too granular at the beginning of an answer, at the beginning of a presentation. It's better to start off big picture. What's the broad characterization I want to make here? And let me start off with that high level, high altitude thought. And then let me get incrementally a little bit more detailed as I go through. But starting off, getting down in the weeds, surefire way to lose your audience.
Hmm. Pitch. When do we know when to heighten up or lower down?
Usually, we're conveying a mood in what we say. If I'm on stage and I'm talking about the prospect of how they're going to come across to an audience, if they incorporate the strategy that I'm talking about, I want to lift my voice. I want to talk about, you're going to have 10 times more memory. You're going to have recall that allows your ideas to stick and to influence them and persuade them and motivate them, inspire them. Like, that tone of voice is one of inspiration. That tone of voice I just gave you is, imagine how good it could be. Imagine the results you're going to get if you do this. That's a mood. That's a tone of voice. That's intonation that is directly reflective of the words I'm saying. So that's an example. I had a friend who has a company, and I asked him the other day, oh, you hired this new guy. How's he turning out? And he said, he's good. I thought, uh-oh, there are problems there. He didn't say, he's good.
Mm.
Same exact words mean two totally different things. The he's good has complete uncertainty around it, a little hesitation, doubt. He's good, has conviction, he's in awe, he's impressed. So your tone of voice has tremendous ability to influence how the words you're saying are going to be received.
Yeah, and I think there's this very important piece that I should have touched on earlier, which is your speech is almost dictated by the audience you're talking to. And I feel like our delivery actually may change based off the audience we have.
I was talking to a friend the other day. This was a hallmark of Barack Obama's communication skills. He was what I call a communication chameleon. That if he was speaking at the UN, that would be a very different speaking style than if he went to a Baptist church in the South, speaking to a congregation, where suddenly now he's dropping his G's and his gerunds, and he's sounding more like the way people in the congregation would speak. But it was subtle. It didn't feel too obvious, too manipulative, too contrived. It was just right. So sure, you always want to know, who is this audience? And knowing your audience is one of the most key components of good public speaking. What can I reasonably assume this audience knows? And I want to make sure I don't speak over their heads. When I have to give a talk or a big keynote, one of the things I do all the time is I get to the event early. Let's say I'm going to be on stage at 9, but they have invite everybody for breakfast at 8. I show up at 8 because I want to go around the room and have as many 90-second conversations with people as I can, just breaking the ice, letting them know who I am. Now, suddenly, if I look out in the audience, they're not a stranger anymore. They're somebody I've actually connected with. But more importantly, I usually say to them, what would you like to learn today? Like, if the communications genie popped out of the lantern and granted you one wish to be a better communicator, what would it be? And that allows me to take the pulse of the room. And sure, I've come with an established presentation I want to give them, but it allows me in the moment to tweak and incorporate the feedback I got before I got on stage, so it's even more highly relevant to this audience. And that's empathy. That's realizing that good communication solves problems for other people. It's about what is valuable to them.
It's about connection almost.
Mm-hmm. And I interviewed Adam Grant for the book.
Oh, he's amazing.
Yeah. And Adam, I asked him, how do you see empathy? And he said, empathy is helping your audience. It's not manipulating your audience. And it's very true. You want to really crawl inside their heads and understand, what can I do that's going to be most valuable for them? And if you don't know your audience, you can't answer that question.
I want to hear your opinion. I do this thing that I, this hack that I've learned to do before every podcast. And I don't know where I learned it from, but the way I speak to you now may not be exactly the way I speak to my mates on a daily basis. But for me to get into this mood of being a podcaster, 30 minutes before I get onto screen with you, I just play my favorite podcaster that I really enjoy listening to and I emulate. Mm-hmm. And I try to almost surround myself with that voice for 30 minutes before I get on screen with you. And I think even allowing yourself to be in a headspace where your environment is promoting a voice that you want to emulate is very important as well.
I agree with you. I think that that's a great tactic that you're implementing there.
Yeah.
And in many respects, as communicators, we're a collage of other people we've observed, who we like. And I mean, when I was a kid, I wanted to be a news anchor. I wanted to be a news reporter. And I watched news incessantly growing up from the age of 10 onward. And so when I got to the stage of my life where I did that for a living, what I found was I was a little bit of a compilation of a lot of different people. So, hey, I really like the way Diane Sawyer interviews people. And so let me just not mimic, but borrow a couple of techniques that she does that make me pay attention to her. Or I like the way he reads a story. And this can really help you in your mindset in presenting and public speaking. We have to sit through a lot of other people's presentations, and sometimes in the work environment, that can be the bane of your existence. But you can make it interesting for yourself if you were to draw two columns on your tablet or a pad or whatever it may be. One is old and tired, and the other column is fresh and original. And whatever you hear the presenter do that feels like you've heard it a million times and is in that conformity zone, put it in the tired and old column, and don't ever do it yourself. When you see somebody on stage who's captivating you, they've got your attention, you know you're going to remember this at some point, put it in the fresh and original column and try it out, road test it. If that person on stage roughly matches the personality profile you have, sure, give it a whirl and see if it works for you. And this is how you develop a persona. It has to be your original voice. It has to be the ideas you want to convey. But stylistically and in terms of execution, this can be really helpful. It makes me think about this conversation I had with Stephen Levitt, who was one of the authors of Freakonomics. And he and I were talking a couple of weeks ago, and he said, I read your book. I loved it. I think it's amazing. And in fact, I read it at just the right time because I had to go to my son's graduation from college. And yeah, I had to sit through a lot of speeches, and some were pretty good and interesting, and others were dreadful. And he said, now, normally I really suffer through the dreadful ones. Yeah, just like, when can I get up and leave? And he said, but because I had just read your book, it was so obvious to me that all the things they were doing that were terrible directly related back to everything you said in the book. So I found that the dreadful ones to me were actually more interesting because I was able to dissect them and analyze them in relation to what you had said strategy-wise in the book works. So I found that just the highest compliment that I could actually make horrible, boring public speaking interesting to people.
It's so fascinating. There's always something you can learn from the top, but there's always something you can learn from the bottom as well.
And that is so true.
And I this other thing that you've blown my mind is I've always thought, pondered about this idea of creativity. I wrote about it. I even made a newsletter about it. I've always wondered, can we truly be creative and create our own ideas? Because I've always thought there's nothing new under the sun. Everything that we've seen has come from something before. But there's something that you've said that is very fascinating to me, which is your delivery can be a collage, but your message can be you. And I think that's where I tend to see people struggle to find their real, authentic voice. Because if the delivery is about creating the most unique composition or a collage of the voices around you that you want to emulate, how do we make sure that our message is authentic to us?
Well, the first thing you should do is never ask ChatGPT to write a speech or a presentation for you. I know it's very popular right now, but there is no way that's going to be in your voice. That voice that's churned out from the LLM is a compilation of millions of voices. And so to me, it is the most watered down content you could possibly generate. And you will be at odds with that content when you get up to deliver it because it's not yours. Not only did you not write it, you didn't even think of it. It's somebody else's ideas. So that is immediately off the table. And I find that what's really effective, and I teach this to the clients I work with every day, whatever you take notes in, doesn't matter whether it's your phone, whether it's a moleskin you carry around, and something happens in real life. You have a conversation with somebody and he or she says something that's really interesting, or you experience something, you observe something on the street that speaks to a broader idea or some trend that's clear to you, write it down. If you don't write it down, you're probably going to forget it. And when you write down that content, that is unique to you. And I find that that moleskin, that file on your phone becomes a treasure trove of content that you can wind up implementing in answers in a Q&A, whether you're interviewing for a job coming up or you're interviewing for graduate school. That material makes you sound unique and different.
Yeah, because maybe our delivery might be a collage, but the only thing that we truly, truly have to ourselves is our perspective.
Exactly. And sometimes I advise clients who are thinking, I have no idea how to start this presentation. And what I usually tell them is, well, let's think of something that metaphorically represents the idea that you want to convey. And it doesn't matter if it's way outside your industry. You know, if you're in the automobile industry, it doesn't have to be a story about that industry. It could be a story about, a food company. But the story about the food company has a metaphorical connection to what it is you're going to go on and talk about. And so that analogy and metaphor device, which is one of the memorable strategies that we lay out in the book, is just really interesting for people. Years ago, I was coaching a group of people from a hedge fund, and they were going to do a panel discussion on Brexit. And a lot of the people on stage were talking in just the most mind-numbingly boring trade, economic concepts. And this one guy who I had worked with, he got up and he said, well, listen, let's face it. You know, before the last prime minister in the UK left office, she was the chess player only had the king left. And she was just moving it around one space at a time till she got checkmated. I don't remember anybody else who was on that panel that day. I don't remember what anybody else on that panel said that day, but I still remember that guy. It was an interesting, different lens through which he was comparing her political turmoil into something I could understand. Just about everybody's played chess. They know the futility of moving that king around one space at a time. It's just death is inevitable. And so not only did the point resonate deeper with me, but he also gave me a little 10-second mental refresh where now I was able to visualize this chessboard, and it gave me like a little vacation from the monotony and the density of talking about Brexit. So after the analogy was over, I almost felt like, okay, I'm ready to hear more about Brexit. And so you can transport your audience to a totally different reality by comparing what it is you're talking about to something else that it has very strong parallels to.
Yeah, so funny you bring that up. the number one rule of copywriting is actually create an image that your reader slash viewer will leave with, because the meaning is actually linked with the image they remember.
Yeah, we're visual creatures, and we have this movie reel that's spinning in our heads at all times. We crave imagery to help us understand things and put things into context. So if you get up there and you speak strictly in an abstract theoretical way, people don't have any film to put through that reel. And then what happens is they'll make their own images. That's what'll spin through the reel. That's called daydreaming. That's where I create imagery in my mind to stimulate me, because whoever's speaking to me isn't doing the job. There are two styles in which to communicate. There's abstract and theoretical, and then there's specific, visual, and anecdotal. And if you can force yourself to be in the specific, visual, and anecdotal realm as much as possible, you will captivate an audience more, and they will remember what you say more.
Huh. Do you think that's why when we hear a horrible speech, we get so drained, because it almost feels like we're doing the work?
That's probably a really good way to look at it. Yes, it's heavy lifting, because you're also not being swept along by this current of understanding. You are having to stop every three words and parse it and dissect it and try to understand what the meaning was. And then you've taken this mental time to do that, and oh my God, I got to play catch up because he's now seven words down the road. It's this constant, frenetic game of catch up, because I had to stop and figure out what he meant by that in the last sentence. And it becomes not only exhausting, but frustrating.
Yeah, that's so good. Bill, so if I were to leave this podcast right now, and I mm-hmm. go for a week, and I go, I'm going to give myself 1 hour per day to work on my communication, what do you recommend I do?
I would try, if you can, to work on building the muscle within you to come up with some of these magnificent seven devices that I talk about in the book. They're devices that people at first might think, oh yeah, my brain doesn't work that way. But you can make your brain, you can teach your brain to work that way. So we've already talked about the analogy and the metaphor, and it works really, really well. People remember it. If you ever speak to a journalist and get interviewed by the media, if you deliver an analogy, I guarantee you they'll print it, because to them it's the most interesting thing, and it also helps their audiences understand something on a level that is common to everybody's experience. Another device that's in the book is something that's called the creative label. And the creative label is an expression you coin. For instance, the Great Resignation is a creative label. Quiet quitting is a creative label. Years ago, the founders of Google were asked, what's your criteria for decisions you make on whether you want to invest in or acquire another company? And instead of giving all these boring metrics and criteria for that it's data-based on their decision, they said, well, it's got to be a product or service used twice a day, every day. It's got to pass the toothbrush test. And the toothbrush test became this creative label that people understood. They knew what it meant. And it's just a great, great device. And you can make your brain think along those lines.
Yeah, so when we practice, it's almost like tackling each device one at a time.
Yeah, get a feel for it. There's also a device we call the twisted cliche, where you take a really overused expression, but you change one little thing that makes it fresh, new, and different. So when I was thinking of titling this book, which I wasn't sure about originally, I was thinking a possible title could be Putting on the Riz. and uh, And of course, for those people listening to us who don't know, Putting on the Ritz was, you know, a popular song in a couple of different eras. But and that's a twisted cliche, right? You remember that.
That's so good. That is so good. And I think one thing I realize is when we try to go all or nothing, and I'll be honest, I'm going to put my hands up. I'm a very much all or nothing guy. And it tends to be very overwhelming when you don't tackle each device one at a time. Mm-hmm. So I think being able to give yourself the time and energy and patience to go, I'm going to do this today, I'm going to do this device today, is very important. Yeah.
I was working, well, my co-author, Juliana Silva, was doing a coaching recently on a book that was written about Taylor Swift's business acumen. And one of the points to be made in the communication of it was that the Eras Tour had generated $3 billion worth of revenue. And so that's obviously a big number. But you can make the data that you share even more eye-popping and even more memorable if you put context behind that number. And so the context here was she made more in one tour than the Beatles made in concert their entire careers.
Get out.
Yeah. That in today's dollars. And that makes that point drive home even deeper. So Don't throw out information and numbers and just let it sit there. Help me understand, why is that a big number? Or when I compare this to that, wow, it seems even bigger.
So good. Being able to reframe is rarely a superpower. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bill, it's been an absolute pleasure. Wow. Time flies.
Appreciate it. I enjoyed that. You were a very good interviewer, by the way.
Thank you.
And I've been doing a lot of podcasts, and it puts you in the upper percentile. Very thoughtful, really good. I think you have a great future ahead of you as a podcaster.
Oh, you're making me blush, Mel. Can I just ask, I ask all my guests this, if you'd like to say it, please do. What is the best advice you've ever received?
The best advice I've ever received? Well, I worked in TV and for many years, and the best advice I ever got was, don't suffer from the curse of knowledge. You may eat, sleep, and breathe a topic all the time, but don't assume your viewers do. This may be a completely new concept to them, and if you don't help them understand it, you'll lose them. So make sure that you know your audience, you're always bringing them along on the narrative ride, and you're doing everything you can to help them understand something and also be able to grasp why it's important.
Very, very cool. Very cool. Bill, where can we find your amazing book?
Speak Memorably, The Art of Captivating an Audience, is on all the online retailers you would expect it to be on. And it's also in bookstores and on my company that I founded 25 years ago is called Clarity Media Group. And you'll find a fun list of clients with whom we've worked over the years, names you probably recognize. So, if you want to connect with me on LinkedIn, Bill McGowan, I post regularly. I record video tips to help you be a better speaker. So that's a terrific resource as well. And my first book, Pitch Perfect, came out a number of years ago, which is also another resource.
Love it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It means the world.
Rishi, it was my pleasure. Take care.